WFYI podcast brought to you by Bloomington, Indiana, an American college town offering food and drink, college sports, outdoor activities, live music, cool art, and good times daily. Everyone is welcome in Bloomington. More information at visitbloomington.com.
The Senate GOP unveils its proposed budget. The Senate changes the Don't Say Gay bill. Plus, the state Supreme Court weighs a COVID class action ban and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review, for the week ending April 14th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, the state budget plan unveiled by Senate Republicans does not include any expansion of the state's school voucher program, marking a major split from the House GOP.
House Republicans want to allow families of four that earn up to $220,000 to be eligible for vouchers while removing all other eligibility guidelines. Senate Republican budget architect Ryan Mishler says he and members of his caucus have concerns about that increase, but he says the final budget could include some expansion.
I mean, I can never sit here and say never because they're pretty adamant about it, and so we'll just have to talk about that in the next 2 weeks.
The Senate GOP budget begins to divert some local property tax dollars away from traditional public schools to charter schools. Democratic Senator Eddie Melton calls that a new model that hasn't been fully vetted and discussed.
We know many of our school corporations are in impoverished areas. They're still struggling with assessed value. They still struggle with a variety of funding issues.
The Senate budget plan does eliminate textbook and curriculum material fees for all K-12 public and charter school students.
How will voucher funding shake out in the final budget? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, who blinks first on vouchers?
Well, it's a biennial tradition for the Senate to blink a little. This is really the cycle. The House is very aggressive in expanding charters and funding that expansion. And they did that in the first half. They removed a lot of the, you know, or expanded who could actually go to a charter school and take advantage of that, of those dollars. And the Senate, you know, went the other direction. But what they normally, but again, what they've done in the past is they'll land somewhere, probably not in the middle. Yeah. They normally land somewhere that leans more towards, you know, the Senate's aversion to want to do that. One thing I thought was interesting in the K-12 budget that's now dropped below 50% in the Senate budget for the first time that I can recall, and Senator Mitchell
50% of the entire budget.
Of the entire budget, yeah. Right. It's a share of the budget, and the explanation for that was the Medicaid forecast and the growth of that. And the last time that happened, when we had a part of the Medicaid program on this trajectory, remember, for years we had protections in place for institutional nursing homes, right, in the long-term care program. And there was always a push for managed care in that program that the health and Medicaid policymakers always resisted. And then when the fiscal guys started seeing where that growth curve was going, that's when the law changed, and now we're going into a managed care model for the Medicaid long-term care program. But it was interesting that he flagged that and what we do in that Medicaid program going forward.
So last time on voucher, in the last state budget, again, it exactly what Mike just talked about. The House goes very aggressive, the Senate doesn't, and then they meet somewhere between those two positions. But there was we had a revenue forecast that determines how much money lawmakers actually have to work with in the next state budget. That's coming up this
19th,
week
yeah.
On the 19th. The last time there was $2 billion new dollars that they weren't expecting. So it was kind of like, well, let's do everything now.
Right.
This one, everybody's kind of expecting will be roughly in line with what the numbers they've been working on this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Given that, do we end up towards some expansion, but not a ton?
I wish we wouldn't. I mean, we're now giving welfare to the rich. 220,000 and they're eligible for vouchers under the House program. And, you know, that is the original idea behind the voucher program was to save students from participating in failing schools. We've forgotten all of that. I mean, talk about the camel's nose under the tent, the camel's in the tent. And it's ridiculous the amount of money we're spending on that and how much we're depriving the 93% of the students who go to traditional public schools of those revenue. But the Senate version isn't much better because the growth in property taxes is going to go to these charter schools. We're taking tax...
Well, that's charter schools, not voucher schools.
I understand, but it's still expanding at the expense of public schools. And when you have that situation, when you take tax money from entities that are elected to spend it and to raise it, and you give it to private entities that have very little, if any, supervision, both in the charter school context and in the voucher school context, I mean, that is fraught with risk. We don't know whether those charter schools and the voucher schools are paying their principals, $250,000 and providing health care for their employees or anything else. And it is absolutely a disgrace that tax money is going into those pockets without accountability.
I'll note that unlike the schools that receive vouchers, charter schools are public schools and that they have to take everyone.
No, they don't.
The state law says anybody
if
who
they
goes,
if they have,
if they have space,
lottery.
That's true.
Well,
if they
and
have
if
space.
They, and
but otherwise,
if,
they,
if
are
they are
required
already
by law
functioning in that, a lot of these schools that they're taking over are antiquated, and they may not have elevators in them for kids with disabilities. They don't take those kids either. So they don't take everybody.
If they physically can't, yes. But they can't just turn them away the way a private school can in the sense
and
that...
And the way
like,
a public school can't.
So we asked Todd Houston, in fact, I think it was one of your reporters who asked Todd Houston yesterday in this voucher conversation. So there's two things the House did. One is they raised the income eligibility up to $220,000 for a family of four. But they also took away all of the pathways, the sort of, well, you have to have gone to a public school first or have had a sibling in a public school first, et cetera. Todd Houston, of course, didn't negotiate against himself and said, well, we care about both. But when the question was, which do you care about, if you only had to do one, he was really into getting rid of the pathways. Is that the most likely scenario we see?
Yeah, I think that's where they're headed. I mean, the pathways have slowly expanded over the years. And initially it was you had to attend a failing school. That was the whole basis of
the program.
But the one biggest one, well, no, first of all, you had to attend a public school, period. A failing school, period. Yeah. Now, whatever school, even if you're going to an A-rated school, you still have had to go to it for two semesters. That's the big one I think they'd like to get rid of. And frankly, that funds current private school students who never had any intention of going to public school.
Right, and whose parents can probably afford to send them to private schools since that's what they've been doing.
There's also this charter school piece, which is that the Senate budget starts to lower the charter school grant, so that's money just specifically went to charter schools, starts to bring that down while giving charter schools some property tax money. Now, to explain this very quickly, what it would do is it would say, okay, so in that school district for the public schools, you take a three-year average of the property tax, property taxes that they get or the assessed value or whatever, and then if it increases, that's where the money for charter schools would come out of. So if you have an area that isn't getting much of a boost in property tax revenue, the charter school really wouldn't see much money. Is that likely to be in the final budget? Is that something that we are moving towards?
There's so many plot twists and turns here. And I guess we should applaud the creativity to try to find mechanisms to address every scenario, which is, I think, we'll stipulate an impossibility. I don't think it'll necessarily be exactly what we've seen in the Senate version. I would agree with what's been said. These are the parameters, and we'll probably see something in the middle. And I agree also that the pathways will bite the dust entirely or in practical terms. And that's why we have Legislative Services Agency, a nonpartisan or bipartisan entity which does cost analyses and looks at the impact of programs, says looking forward this could be as many as 90% of the students and families who would benefit from these vouchers would have never, to Nikki's point, would have never set foot in public school.
It's welfare for the rich is what it is.
I mean, it does, but let's just say it is a dramatic departure from what was put forth in 2011.
Don't be afraid.
And it's the other thing, that this is just an example, and we could have predicted this because just as the supermajority in the House has its fixation or obsession I don't know what the psychological term would be. The Senate does, too. Now, theirs happens to be paying down debt. Yes, and so I think people on the opposite side of the rotunda look at their counterparts, their Republican counterparts, and go, what is the obsession with paying down pension debt? And then the others are saying, what is the obsession with
welfare for the rich?
So, yeah, I mean, I guess we all have our pet projects.
I just want to make one little note on the charter school thing you were talking about, which is kind of fascinating. Right now, the state is giving an extra grant to charter schools of cash. And so I do think it's interesting that by doing it this way, they're taking away the state obligation and putting it on the backs of property taxpayers. When the whole idea back when we did caps and all that was the state was taking over operations of public schools.
Right. They did the opposite of textbooks. They took that obligation.
Yes, that's true. The Senate, the House Republican budget said no more textbook fees for parents, but it made schools find dollars within their budget to pay for that. The Senate, like the governor, is a direct line item, so the state is taking over that cost.
You're going to give, I mean, the Senate version would give property tax revenue to charter schools. Those charter schools may not have students from the area where the property taxes are being raised, if I understand what they're doing correctly.
I actually think no.
There's been versions of that, but I think the way it is now, you have to be.
Yes, the student now has to be from that county that or a contiguous county.
Well, that's
but the county doesn't.
I thought that was what the language said.
The county doesn't necessarily, you know, the taxes in Washington Township are not going to be the same as the taxes in Lawrence Township.
It's not quite that.
At a minimum, that has been considered. Whatever it says now,
they rejected it, but they considered it.
You raise a good point about the governor and what he had proposed. Just to point out the obvious, we often think of these final negotiations from here to the end of the session as a two-person or two parties. No, it's three, because the governor certainly and the administration will weigh in too. And in that regard, I think it's clear that the Senate proposal is a better reflection or a closer mirror of what he wants. Yeah. So the odds are stacked. It's not a 50-50 proposition. If he weighs in and expends political capital, he may well carry the day
in that
regard.
It'll be a first if he does that.
A bill reminiscent of Florida's Don't Say Gay legislation, which was called by someone now in Indiana as Don't Say They, passed out of the Indiana Senate this week after significant changes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comber-Weiland reports Democrats fought against the bill's passage during floor debate.
The bill would limit teaching human sexuality in pre-K through third grade and would require teachers to notify parents if a student changes their name or pronouns. Senator J.D. Ford testified against the passage of the bill. He says this bill puts LGBTQ youth in an uncomfortable position.
It's simple respect. Just call kids by the name that they're asking to go by.
The bill initially defined what subjects could not be discussed in schools, prohibiting topics such as gender identity. It has been amended significantly to just prohibit human sexuality, which many opponents say is vague. The bill passed 37-12. It now heads back to the House for further consideration.
Ann Delaney, so the bill originally said that schools, you know, if a teacher, you know, a student comes up to a teacher and says, I want to change my name, I want to change my pronouns, the school then has to go to the parents and get consent for that change. Now it's merely notification. Is that a reasonable change?
Does it make the bill less onerous? Yeah, sure it does. It still shouldn't pass. I mean, it's just an attempt by the Republican majority to beat up on a subgroup so that they can show their primary voters that they're tough. That's all this is. I mean, the idea that teachers in preschool are teaching sex education is ridiculous. You don't learn about that in first, second, or third grade or preschool. So it's not happening, and yet they have to pass a bill, a solution in search of a problem. They're doing the same thing with this. I mean, parents know when their children are transgender or when they're gay. They know that, okay? And if they don't know it, it's because they willfully don't know it. And that makes
that... Or because the child is trying to hide it.
Maybe
really
the child,
hard.
Or maybe the child doesn't realize. I mean, that's also possible, depending on the age.
Sure.
So all they're trying to do is to show to their primary voters that they're tough on transgender issues and tough on anything that have to do with sex. And it's just reprehensible that they pick, you know, they started out with gays in general. Then they found out there were too many of them. So now they've narrowed it down to transgender because it's a smaller group they can beat up on and still show toughness.
When we talked about this bill the first time, we talked about the idea of that a lot of parents want to know if something like this is going on with their kids. And in a lot of cases, I think we as a society want the parents to be involved and to know. So, but there are those hopefully smaller cases where it's probably not a good idea for the parent to know. Consent to notification in that sense, does it make much of a difference?
No. Well, no, because to that point, you're still requiring disclosure.
Right.
In either case, you're requiring some communication between the school and the parent. And again, despite when we talked about it last time, this is too blunt of a solution for me, because like I, as a parent, I'd want to know, but I'm not beating the kid up when he comes home either, or marginalizing him, or telling him that but there are parents that, and the school knows that largely. They're not always going to know that, but the school, these teachers know these kids. You can look at this in a more comprehensive way. Okay, the kid came to me and said, I'm a he, not a she. Okay, maybe I also know that family's poor. Maybe I also know that there's, marital issues at home because of other things that have happened in the classroom. So given some flexibility to school corporations and the superintendents and the staff and the teachers that can see a more complete picture of what's going on with these kids, I think is the way to do it, and the way it's been done.
Yeah. I want to talk about another provision that was taken out of this bill, which was there was language in the bill that said if a teacher, if a student says, I want you to call me this name or I want you to call me this pronoun, and the parents support it, the teacher can say, well, my religion tells me that I'm definitely not going to do that. And there was protection for the teacher in that circumstance. That language was taken out of this bill. I'll ask you, John, are you as surprised as I am that was the case?
Well, this has been a subject of not just legislative debate, but judicial debate. In fact, I think it was maybe a week ago today that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago issued an opinion out of Brownsburg, which essentially said that the school district did not have the right to fire or urging the removal. I don't know, fired
resignation.
Pushing out, let's just say. Which is an interesting opinion because, like so many opinions now that come out of the federal courts, that conflicts with, for instance, an opinion that's very similar that came out of an adjacent state in Ohio a year or two back, which was a post-secondary institution, but the circumstances were essentially the same, and the court opinion was the opposite. So
that's why you have a Supreme Court.
They're going to be busy on so many of these things lately, but I don't know if that played into this because, how often do we hear, it's going to be litigated. Why should we wade into it now? I don't know if that is an issue, but it makes it less thorny probably in the short term.
Now, we'll see what the House decides to do with this bill. They could concur. They could take it to conference committee. But the message we got from Senate Republicans was we think they're, we've been talking, we think they're going to be okay with this.
When they did the amendment to take the language out on the teachers being able to refuse and to change it to notification only, that was done in conjunction with the House author and House leadership in anticipation of a concurrence, and that will go.
Are you surprised by that? Especially on the protection for the teacher language. That's the part that I'm
there was,
shocked
The at. Reason they said that became an issue is because if you have parents who disagree, what if one parent's okay with it, another parent's not, divorces, that kind of thing. I think that really got problematic there.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should a parent be notified by a school when their child asks to change their name or pronouns? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you whether students who aren't going to enlist in the military, whether they should be allowed to use a military exam to graduate from high school. 28% of you say yes, 72% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the 2021 state law that banned class action lawsuits against colleges and universities related to COVID-19 could be struck down by the Indiana Supreme Court. The court heard a case this week that stems from a student's class action against Ball State University seeking a refund after in-person classes were canceled during the pandemic. After the student's lawsuit was filed, the legislature passed a law banning class action suits against higher education institutions related to COVID-19. The Court of Appeals sided with the student, saying the ban improperly interfered with court procedures. But attorney Brian Paul, representing Ball State, says the legislature was making a policy statement to provide schools with relief as they faced unprecedented challenges.
The schools should not have to defend those claims while also facing the costs and pressures to settle that class action litigation brings.
Attorney Colin Flora, representing the student, says the law fundamentally deals with court procedures, which is not the power of the legislature.
The statute now is trying to say you students who otherwise under contract law would be entitled to these refunds, we're not going to give you a viable mechanism to recover your money.
There is no timetable for the court's ruling.
John Schwannis, could colleges and universities be in real trouble if this law is overturned?
I suppose they could be firing up their, getting extra long light serving light bulbs in the office of their attorneys, because there would be a lot of work to be done, as I'm sure students, I mean, this was a common complaint that I've heard it from my kids who were caught up in this in their college years, and I felt it too as somebody who was paying the bulk of their bills. But let's get down to it. I don't think there's a debate over whether there's a contractual obligation that colleges have to offer in person. I don't think there's any contractual obligation about what the forum of that delivery mechanism is. And I also am a bit confused, but that gets off the question of procedure. But let's also look at generally subdivisions of government that Ball State, IU, our state institutions already have wide latitude, aside from the COVID issue, to in terms of sovereign immunity from, unless there's, you know, reckless conduct. And I think most people would be hard-pressed to say that the response to an unprecedented global pandemic necessarily would be that.
That was raised several times in the arguments as well. We've just never seen anything like this before.
And the last thing I would say, if this is about procedure, what about, I mean, the General Assembly, essentially, if you look at the Tort Claims Act in Indiana, it's all formulated by the General Assembly about who's gun maker's liability or...
Yeah. Well, that's a different question.
But that's not purely procedural.
Yeah.
The point is that there's nothing in the state law that talks about class actions.
Right.
That is
those
only...
Those are the rules.
Those are
court rules.
Created
totally
by court rules, class
right.
actions. So that's the point, is that if they are basically passing a law that impacts the court rule, because there's not a statute on...
But they could make them immune, and it could still be dismissed...
They could, but they didn't, and that's the point.
And
that was part of the question was, look, they appear to have taken a balancing act. They could have made them solely immune, but they didn't do that. They just took away the class action, said you could still sue individually.
Right.
And obviously there's an argument
about...
And
that might be where the problem lies, in which case the lawmakers might have to revisit this. Because you're talking about every college and university is now on the hook, potentially for...
Thousands and thousands of dollars. If you don't have the class action, the question is whether it's economical to bring suit for the $5,000 that you may think you're entitled to. But you're right. I mean, this is a court rule. The court has decided that cases that don't have that much in the way of damages can be aggregated for the convenience not only of the plaintiffs but also of the courts. And for the legislature to jump in and say, you can't do that, strikes me as...
They've done that in other issues.
Not quite like this.
That's
the problem.
You can outlaw or you can give a cause of action or take it away. That's different from saying how a cause of action that exists will be handled by the courts.
That's a procedure.
Senate Republicans this week honored the National Rifle Association ahead of its national convention in Indianapolis, a day after a southern Indiana man shot and killed five people in Louisville. The Senate resolution honoring the NRA noted its long history and assistance in helping teach people firearm safety. Senator Jim Toms also gave special recognition to controversial NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre, who has been entangled with allegations of misuse of funds at the organization.
I want to personally thank you for your service and dedication to promoting the Second Amendment rights of our citizens, not only in Indiana, but across the United States of America.
Senate Democrats did not sign on to the resolution, but otherwise didn't oppose it in any way on the floor, whether by speaking about the measure or through no votes during the voice vote on it. Senate Democratic leader Greg Taylor later spoke on the floor about how his caucus showed a respect for decorum.
Nikki Kelly, are you surprised the Democrats really did nothing besides release some statements?
I was shocked. I really was. I mean, we've had several mass shootings in recent weeks, including that one that involved an Indiana company and an Indiana shooter. They had the NRA executives right in front of them. In Tennessee, we've got members so mad about gun violence, they got themselves expelled. In Indiana, they couldn't even stand up. And I understand decorum, but you can still, like anyone else in that chamber, go up to the podium politely.
I mean, more than that, they did a voice vote on the resolution like they do on any resolution. They didn't even bother to say no.
Right. You can politely get up at the mic and say, oh my gosh, we disagree with this, and they just sat silent.
What were the Senate Democrats thinking?
I don't know, but they should rethink whatever it was they were thinking. They should have protested. I mean, it's outrageous that we would, you know, when you look at the stuff, when you look at a Supreme Court that says if it didn't exist in 1865, we're not considering it. How many AK-47s were there in 1865? As far as they're concerned, there is no gun that is not protected by the, that's too many knots, but every gun is protected by the Second Amendment. And I really would have preferred them to stand up and say this is a disgrace. And, you know, granted, they're bringing $36 million, but we don't want them to come here.
John, very quickly here, because we don't have much time, but it would be kind of shocking regardless, but especially in the wake of Tennessee, does it look even worse for Democrats?
Yes.
It looks unusual. I mean, I guess they could say we're Hoosier Hospitality with the $36 million, and if we don't like half the groups that come in here for conventions, if we got into who we agree with and who we
don't,
but
they
this is
on the
different.
Floor,
I'm not disagreeing.
This
I'm
is
really
different.
Saying.
For the record, I thought they handled it great.
Yeah, not bad.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.